You're listening to the Art of Move podcast, hosted by Dr. William Raybar and Anthony Manuel, where we attempt to create a grand unified theory of human movement, biomechanics, and training. If you enjoy these episodes, you can watch them streamed live on nofilter.net, where you can interact directly and have all your questions answered in real time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Art of Move podcast with myself, Anthony Manuel, my good friend, Dr. William Raybar. Will is out in the Canadian Rockies and I am out in Mexico. We are still trying to find the grand unified theory of human movement, biomechanics, functional fitness, how to exist and move within a human body and what that means for our human experience. And we wanted to have a little bit of a solo episode because recently, our most recent episode with Naudi Aguilar went so broad and so all over the place in terms of the topics that we covered. There were some amazing topics, but there were a couple that we wanted to kind of circle back on and have a little bit of a follow-up discussion about, specifically kind of the nature of information and the relationship to science that the public has, that academics have, and that the fitness industry has. And we're going to kind of go a little bit deeper into a topic that we sort of opened up, but we didn't kind of like get right deep into the can of worms of. So, you know, Will has some cool things that he whipped up for us that were sweet visuals, but we're just going to jam a little bit. And Will, you know, what were some of the main points that you kind of wanted to dig into today?
Oh, I just wanted to go point by point and have a discussion, go a little further than we did during the Naudi episode there, and kind of steel man the positions of somebody who believes in, you know, let's say science as the basis of knowledge, science being the consensus of experts. Because I've been there. I used to think that, right? And I came from a school that was very heavily invested in that, and from a paradigm that was very heavily invested in that. So I know what it feels like to think like that. And then we can go into, you know, how the fitness world looks at it, and we can get in the nuances of how it works socially and culturally as well.
Yeah. And, you know, just for a little bit of a framework for people who missed that episode, what we're talking about here is this idea that science as an institution, and when people say come from a paradigm of trusting the science, it's outsourcing your belief about a particular topic to what the experts say or a body of experts say. It's also the idea that the body of human knowledge as it pertains to a subject is the group consensus of academia and academics who are studying the subject in a formal institution, right? So, you know, for example, like the School of Kinesiology in universities, if there's a consensus idea about a first principle, then that constitutes the body of knowledge or like the basis for the body of knowledge. Anything to add to that?
Maybe define what a first principle is, right? Like, to me, it's just the base assumption that you have, and this could be as solid as you want. Let's say it's the truth. Okay. The base assumption that you have that you build upon. Okay. And this is what happens in the scientific field right now, or pretty much any field, right? You have a base assumption. And then let's say, Einstein has a base assumption of relativity, and every physicist is built upon that, right? They would be building upon it saying, hey, we're going to clarify that this is the truth. Mm-hmm. But I think after a while, people forget what the problems of the base assumption were in the first place and just treat it as an infallible hypothesis or first principle, right? And that happens quite a bit in different fields. And I'm saying, I think we have to go back to a lot of base assumptions that we've had, especially within biomechanics and movement and, you know, like the physiology of the body. And say, where did we actually get these ideas, and what are the problems associated with this idea, and can they be better, right? So spinal engine versus brace the core is a good first principle, right? And that comes from the spine being a passive column, being a very stiff, rigid structure that within the middle dissipates energy to your limbs, right? So you have exercises that are built upon that. Like everything stiff, rigid, be stable. Stable kind of equates to stiff. Like you're going to do a suitcase carry, and that's somehow going to carry over to walking and running. Mm. Does it? I don't know. I don't think so, right?
Yeah, just keeping your spine braced against an external load, does that translate to the movement reality of when you're, you know, bounding your weight from side to side during locomotion?
Yeah, I saw Aaron Hirschog like squat you. He was showing stability. He was doing a zombie squat where he's holding his arms out and he's like, look at my stability, right? And he's so stable. It's like, is Aaron actually that athletic? Like, where does this transfer into real world? Okay, where does this brace your core, stiff spine actually transfer into athletic movement and movement in general and pushing pressure through your body? Because I believe that pushing pressure through your body in a smooth fashion, having the bones spin and the soft tissues recoil at a proper sequence, is more far superior to just being a stiff and stable structure. Okay, I think it's the next level of that, but it's not even accounted for. The variable is not there. The first principle is not there, right? So, and that comes from learning off cadavers and looking at the body as this rigid structure, cut it in the middle, transverse, sagittal, frontal plane, and you're that
this
guy.
This is an interesting thing that you're talking about. It's like it comes from cadavers. When you start to reverse engineer what your first principles are, and you start to question, what are the assumptions that I'm actually making about what I believe to be true? In order for these things to be true, what assumptions am I making a priori to the knowledge that I'm building on from there, right? And this can actually be a really overwhelming process to go over. I'm going through it with myself with some biochemistry. I went through it with biomechanics, with physics itself. If you go back and you say, all of this stuff are built on assumptions of things that I were kind of taught about the way the world works, about the way that chemistry works, about the way that physics works. How do we learn these things? How do we figure these things out? And if you go back and you look at the way that some of these first principles were established, some of these assumptions about reality were established, they're kind of flawed. There's a lot of holes in a lot of them. And you maybe start to question, because you're building an entire knowledge base, and human beings are building an entire knowledge base on top of a pretty flimsy first principle, that house could topple down pretty easily if you don't do it. Now, that's a scary thing, because your model of reality, the way that you interpret the world, the way that you're continuing to build knowledge, it's like if you can have this house of cards just spill over at any time, that is threatening, because maybe even you have established a sense of credibility, a sense of hierarchical position within a certain field. Maybe your finances and your safety and your stability as a human being in society is contingent on these first principles being correct. If you go back and you question some of these assumptions, well, then your existence, your personal identity, your safety and security financially or whatever it happens to be, that could be called into question. And that's a tough thing for human beings to do in general. If you undertake questioning your first principles, it will scare you. You will experience cognitive dissonance. I'm speaking from personal experience. I'm not saying maybe you won't. Maybe you're a better person than I am with more more self-awareness. But my assumption is most people will experience a huge amount of cognitive dissonance and maybe even throw like a mental temper tantrum, because all these things that you have assumed to be right about reality are built on really flimsy foundations.
There's so much to that. Yeah, you're talking on a personal level, and that would happen, right? If someone gets their first principles questioned and maybe they don't even realize that's being questioned, yeah, it's gonna hurt a little bit, right? I think that on top of that, society is structured a certain way to work a certain way, and we take it for granted. Like, we are relying on the experts, right? So what happened, let's say, hypothetical scenario, there's a worldwide pandemic, and what do? Do you rely on the experts, and do you stop people from sharing information that may go against that consensus? I don't know, right? When could this ever happen? Who knows, right? So,
and what pieces of information could those experts possibly not be privy to, or what things could they be missing because they're operating on a set of predefined first principles that are missing a broader part of the big picture? Or what if those experts are also biased towards having a particular opinion because of political and financial motivations?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just talking about how society was structured in general, right? Mm-hmm. Because and it currently is, even the Prime Minister of Canada says, trust the science, trust the science. But no one ever really defines that, right? It's like, what does that mean? Do you mean the cultural aspect of it? Do you mean the institutions? Do you mean the scientific method? So they don't even have to define it, because the word itself invokes this trust that's built up over years and years and years. And, you know, you're in school, you trust scientists. Someone puts on a lab coat, they're more credible. Okay. Like, that's a psychological thing. So science is trusted. Bill Nye the Science Guy was someone I watched all growing up. I'm just like, Bill's the best, right? Like, and now I look at him, I'm like, this guy is just the worst, you know? my first principles about Bill Nye were just destroyed when I see him now. I'm just like, this guy's terrible. But anyway, the assumptions are there, right? So let's go through this sheet that I had. Yeah. And we could just go point by point, because there is a web here, and it's very hard to unweave the web unless we talk about it and go point by point, right? And that's why I do split it into, what does the public think science is? Mm-hmm. What do the experts think science is? What is the scientific method itself? What does the fitness world think science is, right? So it has to be split up that way, because the word science is just thrown around, right? Let's do that. Anything to add to that before I do?
Let's pull that up and we'll start riffing on that.
Sure.
Because again, the idea of science as a term, when we had that episode about the appeal to authority fallacy in the fitness industry specifically, right? And the word science can be used as an appeal to authority, because it assumes the most credible source of information, the most well thought out, or the most well experimented, or the most expert reviewed source of information. So let's take a look at that sheet, and we'll go point by point to that here.
So I just wanted to quickly touch on this one. There's a couple episodes that you should, if you're interested in this topic, which you should be, because it's one of the most important topics of our time, even outside of the fitness industry. And I've spent a lot of time watching scientific method debates, physicists debating, every debate I can draw upon that has to do with this, I've watched hundreds of hours, literally, right? So, and I've boiled this down. And again, and I just wanted to touch on this, what is true, what is knowledge? That's epistemology. It's called epistemology. And then the basic scientific method, to me, is just the theory, observation, and experiment. And that is the bare bones of it, okay? And we've added on to this with doing statistics, with doing, journals, with experts. This is not the scientific method itself. The scientific method is a method of discerning truth, of trying to find what is true and what is not true, mm-hmm. right? This has nothing to do with consensus. But somewhere along the lines, even if it was 100 years ago, we said it's consensus. And that is, in order to draw, keep knowledge going and build upon what other people do, you kind of have to do that, right? But it's not a all or nothing thing. You don't just build upon knowledge if you are building upon flawed knowledge. Mm. And I think we're at the point in 2023 where we may be building upon flawed knowledge and not going back to the original first principles and taking a look and audit those. But I digress. Let's go back to, I think I said this point, public, academic, fitness world. Let's go to public first, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the public and perception.
Yeah, so look for what will solve their problem and go to the expert first and have a background respect for science. And you see that, right? Like, mm-hmm. For this point, I can say that in general, if somebody was to have a product, and they put a peer review study, it's like, studies say that this happens, right? Usually the public is like, okay, well, studies say that that happens. And that's as far as they look into it, right? So a lot of people take advantage of this by just showing any study. They're like, okay, I have this water filter machine and I can just pull up a study saying that this science that I have for this machine has a peer review study behind it. Mm. But a scientist who's looking at that would say, hey, wait a second, that's a pretty poor study.
Can you keep that pulled up?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
thanks.
And so, then, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, and there's probably a reason for that. When you think about like an expert, you know, at being someone who you go to, I think one of the examples we used last time is like, if you have an issue with your plumbing, you call a plumber. You have an issue with your lights, you call an electrician. There's a reason that experts exist. There's a reason that specialized knowledge exists. It's because there's no way that, you know, with all the complexities of the way that society works, we need to specialize. Like human beings in general need to specialize. Like you're a chiropractor, you specialize in fixing issues around the body. That is a very specific thing that you needed to spend many, many years figuring out how to do, you know, whether that was academically or like after the fact, as you're putting more pieces together, you know, after your academic education is beside the point. It's just that you specialized your energy and attention in one particular direction. And that specialization allows for people to divert their attention to other things, to specialize in other things that might benefit society, right? So specialization and having experts is something that is really, really good, and that we need to be able to do that to some degree in order for society, in my opinion, in order for society to operate functionally and optimally, right?
Yeah. So how do I say this? Here's a point. Let's say experts, right? Let's take the word expert. And there is a known, like, you know, that they have at least gone through the basic schooling to do something, right? So you're like, okay, I called the plumber. He's certified. I trust that certification. I trust that he knows what's going on. And that's that. But you can also know a guy down the street and he's been fixing houses all along the block for years and years and years. He doesn't have credentials, right? But you know that he knows how to fix. He's got 100% success rate with everybody you know. It's like, who are you calling? Right?
Well, this is the interesting idea of like, what is an expert, right? What's the,
exactly,
you know, in terms of like, who is the expert in the public eye? Well, there is the person who has gotten the results practically. They're showing up consistently over and over again, and they're getting those results, right? And you could almost say functional patterns. When we were talking to Naudi, the example that he kept using was, well, look at the results on our page. You know, no, we don't have peer-reviewed science. No, we're not testing the certain variables the way they're doing. We don't need to. Look, it's here, right? And people care about that. The reason that their page has 500,000 followers is that, you know, they share the results on that page. People resonate with it because they assume it will help them solve a problem. And then they're generating more results, and it kind of, it's a feedback loop. Now, on the other hand, science is one of these things that is given automatic sense of authority because of the rigorous institutional nature of it, because of the pressures of academia, because of all the prerequisite knowledge that you have to kind of get in order to specialize in one particular direction. The more, you know, we kind of looked at that Brett Contreras blog post that he had where he was talking about what a PhD is, where you kind of like hyper narrow focus and then you specialize on a specialization. And, you know, you kind of add to the general body of knowledge in like very, very small micro pointed version. Y'all, like, you're nice. You have it pulled up already, right?
I have it pulled up. Brett Contreras, the glute guy. This is his illustrated guide to a PhD. It's basically almost like a dartboard, a bullseye. And that the circle in the middle becomes a second circle in the middle, becomes a third circle in the middle. And then a little bit of a bulge comes out of the third circle. Okay. So watch this on YouTube and you'll understand. And basically he's saying, you know, a little bit. And then as soon as you start to specialize, you start to hone in on one subject. And when you have your master's or your PhD, that's when you know almost all the knowledge. He calls it the edge of human knowledge. And you hyper specialize in one area, right? Mm. And then the rest of the bullseye the rest of the dartboard is left blank. What is that blank area? Like, what is this area here? And who takes care of, let's say Brett Contreras and the glute guy is learning this, has a bulge here, and the biceps guy has a bulge here, and the foot guy has a bulge here, and they're all going to the edge of human knowledge. Who puts that all together? Mm. Who's the PhD that puts that all together? I don't think that exists.
Yeah, because like, right? Those, you know, like that outline is kind of the assumption that it is all interconnected in some particular way, right? And the issue is too, you're specializing in isolation. That's a big part where it's like, you know, you're talking about the glute guy, talking about the bicep guy, you're talking about the foot guy. Now, that would be really good for an orthopedic surgeon, for example, if you specialize in fixing a particular joint in terms of like someone has an acute injury that they need to have repaired surgically, you would want to be specialized in the structure and anatomy of that particular joint. But when you talk about the body as a system and you hyper-specialize in a body part, it's this reductionist idea that, you know, can start to skew our sense of how interconnected everything is, how everything interplays as a unified system. That can be limiting in terms of the knowledge because you're not looking at the big picture. You're so focused. It's, you know, the analogy I like to use is if you picture yourself in a movie theater, right? And you're sitting far away from the screen and you can see the whole movie. You can see the big picture going on. But say you want to look at one of the details on the screen and you get right up close to it and you get really, really, really close, really, really, really close. And then you're standing like right up with your face against the movie projector. And maybe you can even see the pixel by pixel and you can see the individual details. But when you're looking that close and you're that close to the movie screen, you can't see what's happening on the screen. You can't see the big picture. You can't see what's actually happening. You can make out the tiny details, but you will not be able to see the big picture. Right. And so that will kind of happen if you over specialize and you fail to take into consideration the broad context of everything else that is interconnected to that thing that you're specializing in studying.
Yeah. So this is, I think this is happening all over, quote unquote, academic field science, right? Like if you're a PhD in biology, you're probably hyper specializing in a small, let's say, certain bacteria that goes into a flower and studying that. And again, maybe perhaps missing the bigger picture. Now, you're under the assumption that the next guy is as hyper specialized as you. So you go to, like, if I wanted to know about rocket science, I would go to the rocket scientist who's a PhD and I would assume that he knows everything about that. And then if I wanted to know a certain, glutes, I would go to the Brett Contreras and tell me everything you know about glutes. So each of these academics believes that the academic that's hyper specialized in the field that they're hyper specialized in is the expert in that area. So if I'm academically inclined, I'm not going to listen to Naudi Aguilar. I'm going to go, who specializes in exercise therapy? Let's say I'm a biologist. I'm going to go to the exercise physiology department and talk to the exercise physiology professor who spent his whole life looking at papers. Okay. So that's on the academic end. Within the academic community, it's very shared that the specialist in that area is just as specialized in my area. And we're both under the assumption that we haven't messed up, that we're operating from the proper principles in our own area and that we know everything. But then again, who is the person who's bringing everything together? Who is the academic that's looking at all the academic sources? You would think that, Brett Contreras, since he knows about glutes, he knows quite a bit about exercise, and he probably does. He works in the field too, right? So maybe that's a bad example, but do they know everything? Here's another thing, okay? Hundreds of thousands of papers come out per month. Who's keeping up with that?
Yeah,
and who can have the time to sift through the proper information there and draw a consensus? So, can I go to a academic and go, "What's the consensus on this? What's the consensus on this subject? What's the consensus on this subject?" And is it written down somewhere? Can I find the directory of the consensus? No, I have to also trust a PhD. Or a academic that they have the right consensus, that they are actually telling me the proper consensus, because that's not a public information that's available. That's like in the air as well.
Right.
So if the consensus is full range of motion on every exercise and not partial range of motion, like Joel Seedman says, right? And that ATG and Mike Israetel, the full range of motion guys, have the consensus view and it's proper and that's what it is. I have to trust them. Okay. And same thing with spinal stability. I have to believe it's the consensus. And where are the experts that are coming together and saying, hey, here's the consensus, here's the directory, here's the website, here is the academic model that says consensus on this subject, right? That does not exist.
No.
Okay, so again, that it goes back to trust again, right? 97% of scientists say that the climate is changing. That's a consensus. I have to believe you though, right? I have to believe there's no motivation. And not, let's say I'm someone in the public. That requires a lot of trust, okay? That there's not corruption, that there's not money being paid, that that is actually happening. Well, and that is the consensus.
And when you say 97% of scientists, what scientists? From where? How are you gathering that data? How are you, like, did you just poll every university from every country, from every place around the world?
I think they did do a stat like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they work by stats, right? They're like, let's hand out a survey and let's figure it out, right? And then that's how they would do it. And that's, I mean, they get a p-value, they get statistics in there, and they say, that's the consensus right there. And you got to trust that they're asking the right question, worded correctly, that there's no, and then, you know, cultural and societal pressure comes into play there, which they don't, they're like, yeah, that doesn't exist. I'm blind. That does not exist, you know? So I'm not saying that, like, that climate change is true or not true in this. It seems to be the case, right? But I'm saying that you also have to have a trust that the 97% of scientists, that is a true statistic, and that requires your faith in the scientific institution as an institution, that it's being done correctly.
And that those scientists are looking at the correct relevant data and working from the correct first principles and you know, are forming that opinion based on, you know, relevant models of information, right? And that requires faith too. There's a lot of faith that is required when you outsource your belief to experts. And that is something that, you know, we don't consider very much, you know, in order to, and this is something that I've thought about a lot recently, like in order for you to live a functioning life in modern society, you have to trust that certain things are going to operate in certain ways. You have to trust that, you know, you can just have faith in other people to do the right thing or to fulfill a particular role within society, including yourself.
Well, let's talk about that, because when is it, let's talk about when it's pertinent to have that faith and when you shouldn't have that faith. So let's say I'm looking to an expert for exercise science, okay? And the human body, and I know nothing, okay? And I'm not willing to look at anything. And I'm just a regular Joe in public who's like, oh yeah, I'm getting fat. I'm out of shape. I'm 40 years old. I don't really care about, you know, anything to do with the field or looking at information myself. It's probably smart for you to go, I'm going to look for the expert, right? Otherwise, you can go on Instagram and there's going to be 900 people telling you that they're the best, right? Including Naudi, right? Including Goda, including Weck, including like everyone. And then there's the scientist going like, told you, haha, that's why you have to trust the experts, because there's all these people who are just maybe charlatans. You don't know, because where are their credentials? Where are their, you have no idea as the regular person, right? And a lot of millions of people fall into this category, right? Mm. So I do understand the need for a standard, right? But let's say you're in a different scenario. You're a person who is willing to look at information, who's spent years sifting, like myself, who's spent years within that category actually looking at papers, actually going through the academic process and going, wait a second, this isn't that good. You know what I mean? We're not at a point where I can say that I'm going to just trust the consensus papers. You know, like, one, the field is young. There's not even that much in there. Okay. With that said, there's hundreds of thousands coming out every month or every year, right? There's no chance for a human being to sift through all that information. Some people, no bullshit physio, some people do 5 hours a day of looking into papers and believing that that is how you find the knowledge, okay? And then I would rather spend 5 hours researching how somebody thinks, who I think is an expert from years and years and years of looking at papers, exercise science, different ways of viewing things, watching movement myself, and saying, hey, this person has a point of view that may not be pertinent to academic institutions or have gone through the rigor of peer review and doesn't have peer review paper, but I'm going to listen to what this person has to say or this group has to say and take it into account. The mark of an educated mind is to be able to take an idea, put it in your head, compare it to another idea without believing it. So that's what a lot of people are missing these days is like, you can just take somebody's idea and go, hey, let's see how this works out in my head. Let's do some modeling around it. Let's test it in my own life without believing it. Just because you listen to somebody doesn't mean you have to believe what they're saying.
Mm.
And a lot of people get triggered right off the get-go. It's like, oh my God, he said something different from what I'm saying and like what I learned and just lose it, right? So again, back to the main point, it's like then it would be smart to go past the experts, to go past the quote-unquote body of knowledge, right? I think it would be smart to go past that when you actually have an interest, when you actually will look at the information yourself and go, I'm a human being with discernment. I'm intelligent. I'm not going to outsource my intelligence to the last step of peer review science, because a lot of guys are like, no, you stop there. You don't go any farther. We don't go farther than that. And that's the mentality of like, how could you know more than the science? Are you crazy? Like it's an oxymoron. You can't do it, right? It's like, well, if you define science as the consensus of the peer-reviewed experts and you're willing to go way farther than that and be one of those people who fills in that circle, that white part of the circle,
right,
and Brett Contreras's bullseye or dartboard, then yeah, you can go farther because it really hasn't gone that far in the first place. And I feel like a lot of fields in quote-unquote academic science are falling into this right now. This is an issue because people are sharing information on the internet. And again, they would go, you're sharing misinfo because it's not under our banner. Mm. And then, who's to stop you? Who's to stop the regular person and groups of people? Who's to stop, let's say, functional patterns from doing their thing? They're like, yeah, if you guys want to test us, you can, but we're just going to keep doing our thing over here and sharing our information. And the experts are like, no, you can't do it. You can't share your info. You got to go through us, right? We are the power structure. And it's just like, yeah, you were the power structure, but there's something called the internet, which is similar to the printing press. Okay. This is changing the game and whether you like it or not, it's happening. So maybe a smart idea would be to modernize the way the process goes and not try to stick to, we are the brilliant people with the credentials. We went through these institutions and we have the consensus with our knowledge. You can't go past this. So again, it would be smart to listen to that if you're somebody who is in the regular public, who doesn't want to learn for themselves in general. Yeah, listen to the experts. Right? Now, that would be a smart thing to do.
There are two kind of interesting emergent things that I think could potentially impact the way that we share and disseminate knowledge and information, right? Because we're talking about the issue of like, okay, there's hundreds of thousands of scientific papers being published all the time. Like just a nonstop flow of information. There is no way that one human being could possibly distill and connect and make relevant, like basically understandings and frameworks of all of this data, this raw data that is being poured out into the ether all the time. No human can, but what emergent technology is taking large data sets and extrapolating relevant information from it and generating new, neural connections. AI is one of those technologies. You look at something like ChatGPT, which can basically, you can put these, very elaborate prompts and it can generate these incredibly relevant responses. And it's interesting because I kind of tested some biochemistry knowledge and metabolic knowledge of ChatGPT, and it had very, very good detailed answers about a lot of different things, but again, was operating on certain first principles of biochemistry. And so different people who have different understandings or different frameworks for how metabolism works, I was kind of having conversations and they're like, oh, you know, like this is interesting, but it's missing this information here, which makes, you know, the big picture, which would make this metabolic pathway, not basically it's not true because of this, because it's only looking at it from this framework. Right. And so, you know, AI is really interesting because it could take, in theory, all of this information that human beings, all these little data points, and it could be a tool that we could use to start making these broader connections. Now, what's challenging is that in theory, it could basically be like, hey, like here's how all of this data could kind of fit in together, because you can train it to basically make relevant associations and language-based associations to have, you know, novel understandings of like how this information fits in together. Now, what's kind of scary is that if that AI becomes prominent, if we decide it's like, hey, this is actually the best way for us to take all of this information, because again, not even a consensus, it's like the consensus AI, right? You have all this information being poured in, and it's our consensus bot is spewing out what the new information is. Now all of a sudden, this becomes the new authority. This becomes the new source. And if you hook that consensus bot up to a Facebook or an Instagram or a Google, and consensus bot is now filtering information that is considered misinformation because it's not part. This is the future of censorship, right? Like this is the ultimate future of how to control narratives. Is you have censorship bot and consensus bot working in harmony to make sure that only the consensus as determined by AI, based on data sets that are being fed by academics and experts, are controlling what information is disseminated on the internet.
Yeah, it's already there, really. Like that's just the next step. And a big next step, because it's like what's happening now on steroids, right? But like think about what happened at the start of the you know what in 2019, okay? Mm-hmm. There was a group out of Oxford, I believe, or maybe it was Cambridge, and Niall Ferguson was the guy's name. And he had a model that said that 2 million people were going to die. I think it was in Britain or the US. I can't remember which one, right? And he put the model in, but with poor data. So the poor data going into the model was the issue. And that caused lockdowns. That caused the 2 weeks to flatten the curve, okay? So that data was no good, and it caused the whole thing to spiral. You know what I mean? 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Oh, we got to keep this going. Based on a false data set. And by the way, this guy got caught cheating on his wife across town during the pandemic when everybody was supposed to be locked down because he had false information. But I digress. Back to what I was saying. Basically, you have to put in the right data to get the right output, right? So it's still an issue to begin with. So I don't even think that all the AI in the world, if you don't have the right data in combination, I think that only humans can do this. Because you have to have, again, go back to the first principle. It's like, if I go back to a poor first principle and I go, let's say Einstein was incorrect, okay? And then that's 100% true. And I go, hey, ChatGPT, was Einstein correct or incorrect? It'd be like, no chance, right? Like, and that was just an example, but I still think the human element is there for another 50 years, if not forever, because I don't think AI replaces humans. I think poor data and poor inputs equal poor outputs, even within the AI models.
Yeah, it's garbage in, garbage out, no matter which way you put it, right? That's true of like anything. And this is what I'm saying. It's like, this is the danger of leaning on something like this, because it's very, like, you can hear where it's like, well, yeah, we can't do anything with this data. We have all this data and we're not like really progressing in any meaningful way other than just having all this microscopic little bits of information on the fringes. But we have this technology that can tie it all together. But this is the whole issue. Again, if people are operating on poor first principles or incorrect first principles, and they're feeding this AI all this data, and this AI is making all these relevant associations from a bunch of bad data, it can create a really strong narrative, and it can really, you know, it can fill in its own gaps to make it seem more and more and more convincing that, you know, this basically this mountain of incorrect information built on flawed first principles actually makes sense. Or, you know, in another parallel universe where this could actually be very beneficial, it could see all the flaws in missing information, and it could help people identify why the data is actually not making a lot of sense. It could be like, hey, this all seems to make sense, but, you know, here are the major gaps in what everyone's kind of like looking at. Maybe we should look at it from a different perspective. Maybe that could be, you know, a potential positive outcome of using a technology to create associations between all of these big data points as it's trying to make a big picture. Like if there's a hyper intelligent artificial intelligence that is trying to, its sole purpose is to take all this data and make a big picture, but it's seeing incomplete information. It's like, actually this big picture doesn't make sense based on this data. So we need to actually change some assumptions. Maybe that could be an outcome of that.
Yeah, it's possible. It's hard to say, right? Like, I don't know. That's kind of like looking into the future,
right? Like I'm like futurist, like projecting into
the, I'm in my own personal view, I'm trying to get back into nature, you know, like as much as I want to use technology, I just want to use it to use it. I don't want to outsource my thinking to AI in a major way, right? And I think that even Google did this for most people. I think we're in the whole dumbed down quite a bit, you know, like in general. Anybody who can go to Google and think that they have the answer, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, what does Google say? Or even driving and using maps all the time.
Yeah.
What I like to do is I like to not use maps and try to figure out by viewing things, like, and where am I?
This is really interesting because I think studies have shown that people who use GPS systems excessively, the part of their brain associated with spatial recognition and navigation actually atrophies. Because of lack of use. Makes sense. Absolutely. Right? You don't use that part of your brain. So, and this is something that, like, when I learned that, I was like, oh my God, I use Google Maps all the time for everything. And, you know, now I've been living in Mexico for almost a month. I've just been trying to find stuff. You know, maybe I'll look at the map first to get a general sense of, like, okay, it's north, it's on this street. But then I turn it off and I try to navigate and I look around and I pay attention to my surroundings, and I'm trying to, like, grow that part of my brain back again. Because, you know, navigation is something that's important and inherent to human beings. Like, we want to be able to navigate the spaces that we live in, right? And so, this is also an interesting appeal to authority issue, where you're talking about, oh, well, you can Google something and you have the answer right away and you can just assume that it's true. In a lot of cases, you can. You can Google information. It can be good information in a lot of instances. The issue is that Google has its biases, as we know. All technologies have their biases in terms of the information that's going to be shared with you first. In the Google case, it's interesting because if you have a good, someone who's really good at search engine optimization, and you optimize for being shown first, or you pay for ads, then you can position yourself as the relevant true information, and people will assume it because it's on Google. It's on the front page of Google. Right. And so that's an issue. You know, if this is the de facto authority on how you find information on the internet and it has a bias built into it, well, how do you know that it's true? You have to be a critical thinker in the modern world. As much as it would be nice to outsource your thinking, to outsource to experts, to outsource to different things. Sometimes it's not good. Like, if you're looking up a celebrity's birthday or something of that nature, it doesn't fucking matter. Like, look it up. It doesn't matter. But if you're trying to create a meaningful change in your life, or your health is on the line, or something pertaining to your psychology, or like a major decision that you're making, you can't just outsource that to like a quick, easy fix, having technology or an expert or a search engine tell you what it is that you should do right away.
I just thought of something funny. The fact checkers are like Google's peer review, you know. Like, what are they called, Snopes and all that? That's like the Google version of peer review. And it's like, you have to trust that the fact checkers are not like, let's say I hypothetically thought experiment, I was somebody who wanted to change your mind about something and I had access to, you know, Google and I was the company Google. Would I not want to promote the fact checkers that have my best interest in mind? People are like, that's basically where the public goes now. It's like, let's just fact check this. Oh, it's fact check. Good. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you might want to go a little bit farther. Like, people do swindle each other, right? Like, this does happen. It's human nature. Not everybody's telling you the truth. And they'll go more than two levels deep. You know what I mean? They'll go more than just like knowing that you're going to check the fact check. So like that, it's not good enough. You know what I mean? If you actually want to know something, if you actually want to have correct information, I wouldn't use Google so much.
Right? She's like, yeah, you're Googling, you're looking, you're trying to fact check by Googling whether or not the fact check is right.
Yeah. It's hilarious. Huh? It's like, that does not work.
Okay. I'm going to pivot.
Basically, if you care about something, you got to look at it yourself.
Yeah.
Like, and look deeply and look at it from multiple angles. A hack. And from my end, if you want to know something, try to find a debate on it, because at least you'll get the relevant questions that pertain to the subject.
That is a short-term, that's a very, very fast route to finding out whether or not you're asking the right questions. Because that alone, it's like, how do you even know what questions to ask if you don't know anything about the topic? So yeah, that's definitely find debates on that. That's also why we have debates about biomechanics and stuff on this show, is because we want to get closer to the truth by asking better questions. So I'm going to pivot a little bit to some viewer questions that were submitted via Instagram. You can follow me at anthony.manuel, M-A-N-U-E-L-E on Instagram. You can follow Will at The Art of Move on Instagram. And we put up polls and different questions that you can also DM us questions and ideas that you have for certain episode topics. But this one is somewhat relevant. Is the cognitive dissonance in the world, in all things, just closed-minded thinking?
Sorry, I missed that. Can you say it one more time?
Is the cognitive dissonance in the world, in all things, just closed-minded thinking? So, the cognitive dissonance that people experience that stop them from, exploring or accepting new information, is it just closed-minded thinking?
I think it could be, but I think it's just human nature to feel cognitive dissonance when you hear something that does not compute to your first principles. Back to the first principles thing, right? You're going to have cognitive dissonance. It's going to be painful. And everyone's gone through this process and is probably in some sort of way going through the process right now, where a first principle's challenged. It's painful and you don't want to accept it. I think a lot of times this takes a little bit of brewing in your head to get the ego out of the way, right? Mm-hmm. So every human being has this issue. I don't think it's something that will ever go away. And do I think it is more pertinent now than ever? Yes, because there's a lot of lying going on, in my opinion, just in general. And you'll see things in front of your face that don't make sense, but you want to keep you want to make your life easy. So I think that's the case. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's not like closed-minded thinking itself is like, well, what is the source of closed-minded thinking? Why do people not want to accept new information? That, you know, closed-minded thinking and cognitive dissonance are kind of like hand in hand. They're almost synonyms in a lot of ways. You could almost say closed-minded thinking is the result of cognitive dissonance. Like, someone has that dissonant feeling, that discomfort and that like weird feeling of like something not computing, that could cause closed-minded thinking itself. So it's like maybe like a chicken or the egg situation. That's how I'm interpreting that. Should I start physio school or dive into functional patterns, one of a kind fitness, or Goda? Is physiotherapy school outdated?
I never went to physiotherapy school. So here's the thing, like physios can bill insurance companies, right? So it's much easier. Like, if you've gone through the schooling process, again, you're accredited, right? And I'm sure they teach good information in there too, right? So you're accredited, you can easily bill people, and you can add in functional patterns into your physio practice. Like, people are like, whoa, this is crazy. You know, like, let's say a Goda drop-in or something like that. It's a lunge, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a wild difference in what you're doing at all, and can be justified in any way. It's a lunge. Like people do lunge variations all the time. Like you can easily integrate any of those practices into your physio model, still being able to bill people, because that's one of the hardest parts. People, I get hurt. My doctor tells me to go to physio. You know what I mean? That's as simple as it gets for most people. Mm-hmm. Is I'm hurt, physio. That's what pops into the mind. The expert is the physio. So yeah, it's worth it in terms of like you can bill insurance companies and all that, and you can learn on the side as well.
Yeah, well, and to that point, right? Like say, like in my mind, I think you should emulate and model the people who are getting the types of results that you want to get for people. So if you're looking at functional patterns and you're like, oh, you know, they're solving problems and I want to help solve for people, then go look at functional patterns. If you see, most of the physiotherapists that I know personally end up taking supplemental education because they find that their base level of education isn't practical enough to solve some of the complex problems that their patients end up with, right? And so they will end up, you know, whether or not it's something like functional patterns or GOTA or one of a kind fitness, they will still take supplementary information from other physiotherapists, from other people. Like supplementary education is just almost the norm because you're not always going to get everything that you need, or you're not going to remember everything that you need practically from a physiotherapy degree necessarily, right? Like you said, the benefit, like you said, is because you can bill, because the standard is you go to a doctor and the doctor will say, go to your physiotherapist and then they can bill insurance, is that if you are bringing
Sorry, I think Anthony cut off there. I'm not so sure what is up with the tech, but basically I'm a chiropractor, so it's very similar to physiotherapy, right? You have somebody in front of you, and I have a good education in terms of like, I think I got educated well. However, in reality, when someone's in front of you, people are coming in pain. It's very difficult to navigate what you know. And then what happens is you end up not being able to help somebody, and it's very frustrating, right? So you end up always, almost everybody who actually cares tries to find new information and stay relevant. And you could do both at the same time, right? And you should do both at the same time. You should be constantly learning more and more and more ways to make your treatments faster, get your patients better. There's a couple different ways that you can go about this. A lot of physio clinics, I shouldn't even say, a lot of clinics in general have a model of turning patients fast. You're never going to work with a human being in that capacity and do well for the person, okay? Like, you're never going to be able to change their body and have their full trust if you're a 10-minute in and out type of person. You want to be able to work with people one-on-one. This is what I do. I work one-on-one and I work very thoroughly, and I take everything that I know and I integrate it into one practice, okay? We're talking exercise from all the that Anthony mentioned there, you know, one of a kind. I took functional pattern stuff, GOTA, my own personal testing, chiropractic, and I integrate it all into one system, and that works out best for the patient. So you can do it all at once.
Yeah. And sorry, my computer just completely shut down there. I don't want to repeat what you just said, but basically what I was saying is, like, because you're able to bill insurance and you're going to get that mainstream audience of people who are just going to doctors and will outsource their idea to their beliefs to an expert, they will look to you as the physio, as the expert, and then you can implement interventions that might not be looked at automatically with authority, like functional patterns or GOTA or one of a kind fitness, if it is relevant to help people fix problems. I think it's just a foot in the door and an I will say, like, if you have a physiotherapy degree, you have some level of authority and understanding. Like, it's not completely useless. Is it outdated? I mean, everything is outdated in some sense or another, right? When you're talking about how fast new information is kind of coming out in terms of actual studies and stuff, university curriculums do not keep up to date with current research, because how can you? Like you said, it's like no bullshit physio is spending 5 hours a day trying to keep up with current research. It's like, are the university professors doing that? Probably not necessarily,
Well, yeah, no, it's a good point. And what was I going to say about that? The way you get better is to constantly learn, and you want to be relevant enough that you know what to learn. That is the key, right? And you have to be in the game. You have to have skin in the game, and you have to be able to test and test and test. Luckily, if you're the type of person who tests on themselves, it helps quite a bit. Okay, and you have a good knowledge of your body already, you can test on yourself. I have patients, and usually what I do is I test certain variables on myself, and then I bring it into the office. Mm. Okay, and I do it slowly and integrate it slowly, and if it works, then I keep it going, and I see results. Results are key, and again, that's what Naudi said there. Results are key, and they are. People want to get better. They don't want you to academically jerk yourself. They want you to be able to get them better. Okay. And that's usually what people are in for. It's like, I have pain, get my pain better. Like, it's nice that you know so much, but this hurts.
Yeah.
I need to get this fixed. Okay. This is a little bit different than, like, let's say you do a system like, I'm just going to say WEC method or GOTA or one of a kind fitness or like functional patterns or something like that. Right. They're more of than a long-term game. People will come to them. It's like, okay, I used to have pain or I have pain now, but it's not 9 out of 10 pain, right? Nobody goes to exercise or what they perceive as exercise having 9 out of 10 pain. But people come to a physio and chiropractor with 9 out of 10 pain. They don't care about your exercise at all. Like, they don't care whatsoever. They want their pain gone.
Yeah.
And once you get it to a certain point, you can, now you have buy-in and now you can prescribe the exercises. So there's a lot of that as well. You have to be good hands-on. And that's what there is a renaissance happening in the physio and chiro world right now. I'm going to say that a lot of grads are feeling like, hey, I'm seeing all this stuff on the internet and I didn't learn any of it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm almost a little bit like, I'm not going to say a fraud, but you do feel like do I even know anything coming out of school? Because there's so much information coming at you. Same with, like, this happened to me with nutrition and still is happening. I knew all the biochemistry. You know what I mean? Biochemistry and nutrition, I can tell you, I can go from, I can tell you the whole Krebs cycle right off the top of my head type thing, right? Like, but it doesn't matter. I don't know how to eat. You know what I mean? And then I come out of school, I'm like, whoa, I don't know anything. And this guy's saying this, and this guy's saying this, and this guy seems to know more than me, and somehow. You know, this is happening all over the place. So you do always have to keep up, and you do have to have confidence in yourself. And you get that by caring and test on yourself.
Yeah. Those are really, really, really big things. Like the testing and the practical application of things. That's a really, really big point. You know, I really think that is. And so, you know, when you're looking at systems like, you know, I think one of a kind fitness and functional patterns in particular are very practical oriented practices. You know, it's like, hey, I'm testing this thing. I'm going to see if it works. Oh, it works. Okay, cool. Now it's part of the system. So, you know, that's something to consider. Another question here, does functional patterns address the foot and foot structure in locomotion? I know that Naudi has said yes. He has said that in conversations with us before. And I also think that one of the ideas of functional patterns is that there's a spiraling fascial line that kind of pulls the dome of the foot up. And so part of the foot structure, it's not isolated, you know, from the rest of the system, because functional patterns is a systems-based approach, not a individual body parts approach, right? But it understands the structure of the foot quite well. And addresses it in its own way, right?
I would love to get Naudi's take on that and how he does it. My suspicion is that you're exactly right, that he addresses it through the fascial lines, through fascial integration. And that's how he would say, hey, the foot comes when you actually have connections through your body myofascially, where a system like GOTA would say, you got to get the foot correct first, and then you can start connecting things correctly. So it's almost going about it in a different circular fashion. I think you need both.
Yeah. Right?
It's like, not in my personal opinion. Right. Yeah. And it is individual as well. Right. Like, you know, someone we're having on tomorrow, one of a kind fitness. I'm very excited about that. That's going to be a nerd out episode. If you're into this stuff, watch that episode tomorrow. Yeah,
we're going to get in the weeds of the technicalities of biomechanics.
Yeah.
We're going to be grilling him fucking hard because he's talking a big game.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he loves it. So
it's going to be a lot of fun.
It's going to be great. So, where was I going with that one? Lost my train of thought there. Sorry.
Yeah. We were talking about how, you know, like Goda would say that you need to address the foot first, where our assumption about functional patterns is that you need the myofascial connection first. And you know, like it's, we were both kind of saying, it's like, it's not an either or thing. They kind of have to happen, you know, simultaneously. Right. And I really do believe that. Are you guys familiar with Carl Dietz spring ankle progression or goat drill? I actually don't know. No, Cal Dietz. I'm not familiar, but you were saying prior to the episode here that that you've seen a few podcasts with him or you've seen some interviews with him. What can you share on that?
I've watched quite a few podcasts with him. I don't know that particular drill. I do like where he's going. I think that almost everybody I've seen is working off a muscular model. Okay. Mm. And the way it's traditionally, the way that fascia is traditionally addressed is plyometrics. And I think he does address that. But when I watched his gait cycle and how he's talking about it, it's front and backside mechanics. Let's look at the body from the side, front versus back. And that's okay. But I don't think it is as integrative as I'm going to say I know Goda the best and Weck method. People who understand that the body is a pressurized system that moves from top to bottom or moves pressure through the body and understands the 360 aspect of rotation. Mm-hmm. Okay. And not just rotation as in I'm rotating my body in the transverse plane. That is the old model to me. The standard model that's happening right now. To me, it's spirals, waves. It is literally vortex movement. Okay. It's a gyroscopic motion that happens throughout the whole body. Okay. And within parts. So, from what I've seen, he addresses, fascia with plyometrics and that's great. Okay. So I gotta look into that a little bit more. I'll look into that question specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've never heard of him, so I'll look him up after. And I'm kind of curious if it's kind of similar to some of the stuff that I've been messing around with just on my own, but,
maybe we can get him on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be cool too. So anyways, guys, I have to wrap up. Unfortunately, we have to kind of, this was a shorter episode, but we wanted to kind of get into it. And thank you so much for listening. This is episode 92 or 93. I'll have to double check. But we're in the 90s. We're close to that 100 episode mark, which is kind of wild if you think about it. Tune in tomorrow at 1 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on nofilter.net to watch our episode with Devin Brown, the founder of One of a Kind Fitness. We are going to go very deep into the technicalities of gait-informed strength training. We're going to grill him about biomechanics. He's going to dig into what he doesn't like about other functional fitness systems or what he thinks that they're missing. And we're going to challenge him on everything. And it's going to be a lot of fun. Make sure that you're there to interact live if you want to ask him questions and challenge him yourself. If you want to defend your position and your system, step up to the plate. We'll let people in, you know, both in the chat. And if you want to hit the knock button and join the chat yourself, be a part of the podcast, we can definitely hop you in. So thank you for listening to The Art of Move, guys. We will catch you next time for another episode.
Have a good one, guys. And Devin better be bringing the peer review or we're not listening to anything he says. Just kidding. Right. We'll see you tomorrow. And I'm looking forward to that one. Tune in.
Take care, guys.
All right. Have a good one.